Coming to you live from a tarantula tank in a pet store in South Dakota, it's The Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm drinking a big drink of water right when you said that. And I'm gonna say it. I'm gonna say my name. And I'm Rissa. I thought you were gonna just go with the fun fact. I didn't think we were gonna go with introducing ourselves, so I just took this huge drink of water, and then I heard you saying that, and it was like, crap!
About that. I do have a fun fact, though.
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah, did you know that one time the Dutch traded the island of Manhattan for nutmeg?
Wait, for nutmeg? I thought it was nutmeg.
What? First of all, the Dutch had the island. Second, they traded an island for nutmeg.
They did both of those things.
Who did they trade it to?
Okay, so the year was 1667.
Okay.
If there was a Dutch trading company... That has a name that I'm not going to try to pronounce.
Okay.
But it is abbreviated VOC, which is confusing to me because as science, VOC also stands for volatile organic compounds. The volatile organic compounds had a monopoly on nutmeg.
Okay.
This is very violent baking.
All of the islands that had nutmeg on them, which were in, where were they?
The ocean.
Malaysia area. Southeast Asia.
Right.
All of the islands that had nutmeg were in Southeast Asia,
and
they
were
all
owned. The Dutch
really
get around.
Oh, yeah. They were all owned by the Dutch, except for one. That island was called Run.
I thought you were going to say Manhattan, and I was going to be like, well!
No, they had Manhattan, too.
Okay.
There was no nutmeg on Manhattan.
Yeah, the owners of the island of Run were the English, and the English were like, we're not giving up our nutmeg island. We're not doing that. We don't want to pay for your nutmeg, Dutch. And they're like, yeah, well, maybe we don't want to not shoot you with cannons. And so they fought about it.
The nutmeg wars.
I mean, something like that, yeah. Eventually, they signed something called the Treaty of Breda with the English, which the English were like, listen, fine, you can have your dumb nutmeg island, but we want the only holding you have in North America, which was the island of Manhattan.
Wow.
Yes. So in 1667, Manhattan traded from the ownership of the Dutch to the ownership of the English, which is why... it is now called New York, and not New Amsterdam. That's that fun fact for the day.
That was fun.
Oh gosh, I have been so excited, and by the way, our listeners have been so excited for this colloquium. Would you tell us about the colloquium today, Rissa?
Yes, I'm very excited. So we're going to be talking more about Joan of Arc, Jeanne d'Arc. Okay, so last time we talked about Joan's childhood. We talked about her visions, her meeting with Robert de Beaurecourt, and her journey to meet Dauphin Charles. I'm not going to go over all that again, but just, you know, try to remember, this is a young, about a 17, 18-year-old shepherdess from a little town in the middle of nowhere, who said she had a vision from God. He told her to go raise the siege of Orléans, which was... a great city that had been under siege for several months. And she finally convinced them to send her under armed escort to meet the Crown Prince of France.
Right.
Today, we're going to talk mostly about Joan's military campaigns. So I've been going back and forth whether I think there's more art of Joan as a soldier or as a martyr. I think there's both. They're rather combined. But one of the images that really comes out, and if we get into this later, I'd like to, you know, after we're done with Joan's history, I'd like to talk about some of her influences on art. And one of the biggest images is just this young woman wearing full plate mail with a sword. So we're going to get into a little bit of that today. Awesome. First, I'm going to have to talk about her meeting with the Dauphin, because we didn't get to that part last time. And then, like, mostly today I'm going to focus on the battles surrounding the raising the siege of Orléans. It's not that this was, like, the biggest, best thing Joan ever did. It's just that this was a serious turning point in the war. It was one of the first things she did. It was considered a miracle. And it was the first thing that she had been promised, that God had told her, you will raise the siege of Orléans. And she told everyone, I will do this. And then she did. Last time we left off, Joan had just arrived at Chinon, where the Dauphin, which is, again, the crown prince, was staying with his court. They'd been kicked out of Paris by the English. Joan has promised to raise the siege of Orléans, and she's determined that that she's going to the Dauphin, and he's going to send her to Orléans with kind of permission to help the soldiers that are there. It took them about an 11-day journey to cross all that Burgundian territory that I mentioned before they came to the gates. And when they got there, they had sent ahead a message that Robert de Beaurecourt is sending this girl to you. But they were still, like, super sketch. Like, who is this girl and why did she want to meet the crown prince? So they actually kept her waiting 2 days at the gates while they were like, do we let her in or not?
At the gates? They wouldn't even, like, say, come on inside.
I'm not sure. They may have let her in the city, but certainly not in where the Dauphin was. Until eventually he decided to let her in. And this is where one of the more famous scenes from Joan's story comes in. When she goes to meet the Dauphin, there's a little bit of trouble about what exactly happens. Either the Dauphin disguises himself, or he disguises someone else as him, like basically says, you pretend to be me, and I'll pretend to not be me. Or at very least, he at least kind of drew back and didn't take his rightful position, so that he wanted to make it so that when she came into the room, it would not be obvious who the Dauphin was. He's testing her claims. So she's 17. She's never met him before. There are no pictures that she's seen, but she says she's from God. Yeah, no one has an Instagram these days. He didn't get to take a single selfie. So she's never seen him. She has no clue what he looks like. But she says she's from God. And remember that at the time, kings were thought to be appointed by God. So if someone comes from God, the Dauphin's theory was that if she's really from God, she should be able to recognize who I am. If she's God's messenger, she should know me, who's God's appointed. And I mean, to be honest, he was right. She walked in, walked straight up to him, recognized him as the Dauphin, and you know, bowed and stuff. So his plan worked.
Went straight to him?
Yeah, one of the reasons people say he may have done this is because I mentioned last time about how Charles wasn't the only one climbing the crown the throne of France, right. And how he had been disowned by his mother, who basically said, he's not a legitimate son. He's not really the king's son, to get him out of the way of the English. And so they thought that with this messenger of God saying, you are the rightful king, in this kind of mystic way, that this would support his claims. And it certainly seemed to have worked for Charles, actually. Charles seemed to have a little bit of doubt himself whether or not he should be king. Mm-hmm. And Joan really helped him with that. We know that they talked together alone about something. We don't know what. It's actually one of the greatest secrets, and one which Joan herself swore to not tell, and so it's not in her trial. Even though they asked, she said, I cannot discuss the private matters of my king. We think it may have been that Joan and him talked about matters of prayer. One theory is that Joan was able to tell him three different matters which he had prayed. Like, basically, the king prayed silently in private three different things like a month before. And Joan was able to say, I know those things you prayed because my voice has told me. So basically, a miracle in knowing something she shouldn't be able to know. Joan also says that it was her voice, her advisor, who showed her which person the Dauphin was when she came in. But anyway, all of this really helped to boost Charles's spirit, at least, if not that of his court. But before he sent her out, they had to make sure she was legit. So I was actually kind of surprised to learn this. I think she came to Charles in March. She was not sent out to Orléans until nearly May. And she spent the intervening time. He sent her to a place called Pontier, which is the French theologians who were loyal to Charles, who had been kicked out of the University of Paris, had set up in Pontier. And so he sent her there to be examined.
This is where I keep my theologians.
Basically, this is the backup university city, basically. Unfortunately, the record of this, we know there was a record because Joan mentions it a lot during her later trial, but we don't have it. It's one of the most major documents of Joan's life we don't have anymore. But this group of pro-French theologians declared her to be of irreproachable life, a good Christian, possessed of the virtues of humility, honesty, and simplicity. And while they couldn't confirm that her visions were from God, they said her mission was probably divine, and they wanted to test her claims. They asked her to perform a sign, and she told them that she was not there to perform signs, but to raise the siege of Orléans. So if they would just send her, that would be her sign.
Rad. I love that.
She was very not happy to be kept waiting between March and May, I think. It's interesting to me that Charles tested Joan so much, and he really wanted to make sure that if he was being supported by someone claiming to be a prophet, a saint, a whatever, a visionary, that she was legit. But eventually, after the theologian said okay, and after he talked to her, he agreed. He gave her a new set of armor, I think white armor by one record, and a white horse, and a white standard to lead his army of reinforcements to break the siege of Orléans.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. I know. It's a beautiful scene.
That's some great imagery right there.
I know. It really is. In fact, the image of Joan is really important. I want to talk a little bit, before we get to like the nitty-gritty battle stuff, about just the general presence of Joan in the army. Because she changed some things that are really interesting. Mm-hmm. So one, while she was kind of leading this army... Now, mind, she's not commanding the army, technically. The commanders are still there. They're just kind of supposed to listen to her, which they occasionally do. they listen to her more and more as time goes on, but at this very early stage, they don't always.
Yeah, I was going to say, occasionally? Yeah.
I'll get to a little bit later. They kind of, it takes them a while to kind of grow to Joan and listen. Basically, it takes her being right several times. But she does seem to always have command over the camp, if not like the actual battle, at least the camp. Joan forbade all camp followers, meaning prostitutes, from the camp. She forbade swearing, which this was the army, so that was kind of a big deal. By the way, a good bit of this army was mercenary as well. The soldiers actually find it really remarkable that Joan doesn't swear, and that anytime she walks into a room, if someone is swearing, they stop swearing.
They're like, shh.
She also required all soldiers and mercenaries to go to mass and confession. Basically, she brought with her several churchmen, came and followed, and she would have them host mass and host other kind of congregational things, and said, "This all soldiers are invited, provided they hear they confess to someone first." And so there was other. She confessed a lot, if not every day, then more than once a day, then very very frequently. It was very important to her. She also forbade the looting of civilians, which had been a real problem in the Hundred Years' War. Even when the army was running out of food, she forbade the stealing of food. There's one story in which someone gives her something to eat and then tells her it was stolen, and she, like, almost hits him. Like, almost really strikes him.
Oh my god.
Also, really remarkably, the army stayed intact under Joan, despite getting very low pay. The royal coffers were basically empty. They were having enough trouble supplying food and gunpowder for the campaigns. They could not pay most of the soldiers or mercenaries, and they all stayed. including Lochir, who is one of the biggest mercenary leaders, and really becomes one of the very good friends of Joan, leading several campaigns and riding with her. And it was, some of the soldiers considered it one of Joan's chief achievements to get Lochir to stop swearing.
I love that.
Yeah. So there's also Joan's own military capabilities were interesting. I mean, she was a shepherdess, but by every record, Joan could wear armor and hoist a lance as best as anyone. And by the end, there was one place they were having to start a siege, and Joan immediately started setting out, well, here's where we should put all the watch soldiers, and the other generals were, they said it was as if she had been doing it all her life, stationing soldiers on a wall and knowing exactly how to do it. So there was some comment about that as well. Before they sent her out, it was kind of like a last minute, oh, wait, you can hold a lance, right?
Oh, my God.
And she could, but it was like, okay, we checked. Yeah. But anyway, he finally sends her where she wants to go, Orléans. So Orléans has been under siege for about 6 months now. And Orléans is a walled city near the River Loire, and there are several smaller fortresses nearby. All of these fortresses are owned by the English, and it's how they're keeping their supply train guarded, how they're really keeping a foothold here. And the French know, even if we fight the English in the field, they'll just retreat to the fortresses and come back. We have to take out these fortresses. Mm. But they're all on the other side of the river. And several problems. One, the French don't have enough boats. Two, there's a little confusion here. Either the wind is blowing the wrong way, and we'd have to fight the wind and the river to get there. Or the river is too low, and the boats won't work. Or both. Ooh, something has them stuck. Good. So Joan wants to take her people and go straight into the English. But when she gets there, she finds out she's been, well, misled a little bit. She arrives on the wrong side of the river. Not on her mistake. She was told to go here, and she didn't realize that they were telling her. They were basically, they didn't tell her she'd be on the wrong side of the river when she got there. But she meets with Jean de Dunois, the bastard of Orléans. I mentioned him last time briefly. He was injured during the Battle of the Herring. But he's here now. And she comes up to him and is like, are you the bastard of Orléans? And he's like, yes, I'm so glad you're here. And she's like, are you the man who made it so we came to the wrong side of the river? And he's like, yeah. Yeah, that was me. I thought it would be smart. And she's like, really? And then they don't have enough boats to get everyone off at the same time. But one story is, and this story we have on several records, including Jean de Dunois, who survived Joan, by the way. We have a first-hand account from him of this incident, that as soon as Joan arrived, the wind changed course, and it was pointing the right way now. Eventually, they decide, well, let's at least get Joan into the city. That would be good. And they think that there's some more reinforcements coming, so they really want to wait until all of their armies are in one place, and then we can do stuff. So Joan eventually lets them.
Okay, yeah, what does Joan think about this plan?
Well, the problem here is what I said about them not listening. So, Dunois, then the other commanders don't really want to attack the English right now. Joan does, and the problem is they're not really listening. She doesn't actually get to go into all of their war councils and stuff, and she knows there's stuff they're not telling her, and she's very frustrated at that, actually. Joan does, however, she has a letter written to the English telling them to surrender. The second day she's there, she goes in person to, there was kind of this half-broken bridge, and she came and stood to the end of it, and spoke to the English commander and told him, surrender in the name of God.
Whoa.
And he didn't. And they called her all sorts of terrible names. And then she went back in. And, yeah, during the next few days, mostly it's Joan saying, hey, we should do things, and then no one listening to her, and then them all making plans and not telling her.
Oh.
Yeah.
What, did they think she was just going to be a good luck charm? That's dumb.
I suppose. I don't know. But they certainly didn't think she'd be the the, you know, real commander that she ended up being. So one of the more dramatic moments that we do have kind of scene by scene record of is, so Joan is going to sleep in a house near Orléans. She, and one of the other commanders is nearby, and she wakes him up in the middle of the night and tells, and he's like, what? And she's very troubled, and he's like, what happened? And she says she needs his advice. She knows she has to attack the English. God has told her that that's what she has to do. But, and we actually see one of the first glimpses of Joan being unsure of herself here. She doesn't know, she's very conflicted. She doesn't know, do I attack their main commander, Falstaff, or do I attack the fortresses? I don't know which to do. Joan isn't trained in tactics. She doesn't know which to do. But the commander tells her that there is an assault on a fortress already underway, which it turns out no one had bothered to tell her about.
Oh my
gosh.
That's
great.
In fact, I mean, the story goes they told this page boy, you should tell her, and then he forgot.
Good job, page boy.
And anyway, it's the middle of the night. Joan immediately calls to get dressed in her armor. The hostess, the lady that was hosting them in her house, has to help Joan strap on this armor. She orders the page boy to get her horse ready, and
does
the commander has to yeah, he does.
Well,
the commander actually
right.
has to lower Joan's standard down to her through a window.
Oh,
and she rides off, and then he has to get dressed and ride off after her. Yeah, so that's kind of a fun story. But on the way there, they start seeing wounded French soldiers, and
oh,
kind
no.
of you can tell that there's a war going on. And
shocking,
I know. But they get to the fortress, which the French had been trying to take. The French aren't doing so great, but you know they're still there. And she shouts to the French that God has given you the fortress, so you may take it. And it said that, you know, when she arrived, the English fell back, the French took the fortress. And there's a couple of stories here that I think really speak to Joan's character and her actions in war. First, there were some English churchmen inside who came out to Joan, and she made sure no one harmed them, even though they were English, because they were churchmen and in you know, church clothes. But second is that Joan wept over the dead English soldiers, for they had died without confessing.
Oh.
It was really important to her, confession. And there are several accounts of different battles of her mourning the deaths of these soldiers, that they had died without kind of submitting to the Lord, basically. After this, the war council still kind of ignored Joan for a little bit. And obviously this really frustrated her. I think there was one point where someone came to tell her what the war council had decided, and she said, "You have had your council, and I have had mine," for she often called the voices she heard her council. "And I know that the council of my lord will be carried out and prevail, and your council shall perish." So, at the same time, Joan had actually made a prophecy about herself again, that she would fight the next day and that she would be wounded. And she said she'd be wounded, I think, above her breast is what she says. So a high wound, basically. And some people say that she specified it would be by an arrow. So anyway, that was the day before the battle. So Joan in battle. I want to talk about this a little more broadly and then get back to Orléans, because this, I mean, this happens a lot. Battles, I mean. So Joan didn't always command the armies. Commanders usually listened to her, and soldiers listened to her. She tended to be in the midst of the battle with the soldiers, and she carried a standard, a white banner with the name Jesus Maria. Jesus and Mary. It had the sign of the cross and angels and Jesus and the world. There's a lot of different images put into this banner, but mostly it's just described as the banner that says Jesus and Maria. She did carry a sword. One of her swords, she has a couple. One of them, there's a story that she found at the Church of St. Catherine. But Joan says she never killed anyone, actually. She said she once broke a different sword by striking someone with the flat of it. But for the most part, she led with her banner. There are records of her carrying other implements, like a small axe and stuff, but the thing she cared about was this banner. In fact, she carried it so much and had such an effect with it that during her trial later, they questioned her, like, is there something magic about the banner? We have to know about the banner. So during the final assault to break the siege of Orléans, Joan was indeed wounded in her neck, between her neck and her shoulder. She was shot by an arrow which pierced her through to the back and knocked her down.
Holy crap.
She was carried off of the battlefield, and they treated her wound as best she could. And Joan said that St. Catherine came to comfort her during this kind of period. While she was off the battlefield, the discouraged men began to call off the attack and retreat. And Joan got up, spent about 15 minutes praying, and then remounted and took her standard and went back into battle with a very wounded shoulder. Forces say that when the French saw this, they stopped their retreat, and the English became so afraid that the French were able to strike them down.
Wow.
So the English start running away. And here's another kind of story that became legend. They say a local fisherman had been hired to... they had been paid for his boat, that he would beach his boat and ignite it under the bridge to weaken the bridge. So basically the English... start getting beaten by the French as Joan comes back onto the field. They start retreating to cross this bridge, and the bridge lights on fire from below.
Oh,
and then the bridge starts falling under them, and Joan yells out to them to submit to the King of Heaven, for he has great pity on their souls. And they don't, and they die. And this was weird, because actually the killing of noblemen was not typical in war. Several of the people on that bridge would have been taken ransom. And so part of this story, this whole fire came from under the bridge, kind of help kind of this image of Joan, even though I'm pretty sure at least some of the French knew that, hey, we paid this guy to do this thing. The English definitely saw it as a witch summoning fire from hell type of thing.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Joan also, that's what it was. So the people who did escape the bridge, Joan did not pursue, not because the bridge was out, but because tomorrow is Sunday, and we don't do fighting on Sundays.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's a kind of a repeating thing here. It's common in this area for both sides to respect the Lord's Day and not fight on Sunday, but Joan was especially insistent about it.
There were a lot of days the church tried to limit fighting by saying you can't fight on Sunday, you can't fight on Christmas, you can't fight on this day, and this saint's day. People tended to ignore
all these feast days. Yeah. Well, Joan didn't, surprisingly. Not surprisingly at all. Like I said, this has all been one battle. So, because the French and English really do consider, both of them considered this as kind of a turning point, and they both considered it to be done, at least in some bit, by a miracle, or I don't know, by magic. The fortresses surrounding Orléans could have been held by a handful of men. And Joan's, like, the English had a lot more than a handful, but Joan's smaller forces took away these larger garrisons. And between the prophecies and everything else, this finally won her the support of the Dauphin's court. And I think the Archbishop, I believe, declared, you know, she recognized her as a messenger from God. It was also important to the English on religious grounds. So ever since at least the Battle of Agincourt, the English had very much been functioning under the belief that God was with them. And that's why they kept winning, was because God wanted them to be here. So when this farm girl shows up and claims she's from God, the English don't believe her.
And they called her
a lot of names. They called her a whore. They called her a witch. They mocked and said they would burn her. And after that whole fire on the bridge thing, some of them actually believed it. When she claimed she was from God and won, seemingly by a miracle, but they thought they were from God, and so they didn't really know what to do with it.
So it was like a real theological crisis for them too, not just a political one.
Yeah, very much so. Which, I mean, is compounded whenever they just end up... Obviously she's a witch, she's a whore, she's everything else, because that's what people say to women who say things that are correct.
Yikes.
Sorry.
Some hard-hitting commentary here, and it's not wrong.
You're not wrong.
But anyway, we've got a lot more battle things to cover. So, having provided this sign that she had prophesied by breaking the siege of Orléans, most of the French court of the Dauphin ended up supporting Joan. And, of course, she immediately insisted the next step, the next thing God had told her to do, we must take the Dauphin to Reims Cathedral and crown him king. Joan is very insistent on this because everyone keeps delaying. They're like, yeah, yeah, Joan, you're right, we should. And then they just keep not.
Oh, why?
And she's like, no, 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 God told me to do this thing. We have to do the thing now. So they decide we need to take back some of the south first. So there actually is a campaign to take back some of the south to really secure the French foothold. One of the reasons they keep delaying is that Reims, so Reims Cathedral is where it's the historic proper place to crown the king.
This is where Charlemagne was crowned, correct?
Exactly. This is where Charlemagne was crowned. That's so why it's gotta be the crowned place. There. And it's really important that the English claimant to the throne has also not been crowned here.
Hmm. Why not, though?
Because he's a child.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
And because he's wrong.
Yeah. Reims is deep within Burgundian territory. So Reims is actually a little bit closer to where Joan grew up than it is to where she is now. But they have to go back. This is a problem. But to be honest, it doesn't cause too much of a problem. Like, they all whine and say it's so much of a problem. But on the way, they retake several smaller cities just by, like, Joan writes them a letter. And it's like, hey, y'all should surrender to us in the proper
king. Here I come!
Basically, because the Burgundians... Okay, the Burgundians are under the Duke of Burgundy, who used to be, like, a subject of the king. And so she's basically like, hey, you know that king who's, like, your king? That one? He's coming. You should probably let him in. And they were like, okay. There was one city that tried to resist. And they put up a siege during which the army ran out of food, which was supplied in the end by another bit of a miracle. This one was a bit of a miracle in advance. There was a preacher in the area who'd been proclaiming that the end of the world was coming and everyone needed to plant beans. So everyone did. And then the army came and they were like, hey, look, there's a lot of beans ready for us to eat.
So how did this go with not looting?
Yes, that's one of the problems. I think, well, the beans, I think, were actually given to them. But they did run out of
food. Oh, the end of the world is coming and here comes the girl you all been hearing about. Here comes the
army. We should probably feed them.
Here comes the girl who can summon fire. Let's give her some beans.
Yeah, there was, I think, there was one commander eventually. So it's really important in these days who you surrender to. So, like, if you're a knight or duke or whatever you are, it is bad of you to surrender to someone of lower rank than you. So at one point there was someone who demanded to surrender to Joan herself because he would only surrender to the most courageous woman in the world who would defeat the world, basically.
Nice.
Talk about a glowing recommendation.
I don't think he did end up surrendering to her. I think they made him to surrender to someone else in the army or whatever, but it was still cool. One of the few stories we do have is Joan says that often people don't believe her. And she gets very frustrated that people don't believe her. They don't believe that she was from God. They don't believe what she said. And so she says when this happens, she withdraws alone to pray and complains to God that no one believes her. And she says when she does, she hears a voice in response saying, "Daughter of God, go, go, go. I will aid you. Go." And she says it brings her great joy, and she wishes she could always feel like she does in those moments.
Wow.
And it said when she said this, she said it to Charles with such... She put her eyes to heaven and just reveled in the thought of this so much that it's one of the things that really convinced Charles, wow, she's right, we do need to go to Reims.
Wow, but like that I said, encounter with the sublime like that, that's amazing.
I know. It's fantastic. And I think, like I said, she participated in several more battles. We have a lot of records. I'm not going to go into them all, especially not in depth like I did with Orléans. but we know at one point she was struck in the head by a rock and was said to immediately arise and shout for the troops to continue following her. At another point, she saved a general's life by telling him, "Hey, that cannon is about to shoot right where you're standing." And he moved, and then they did.
Wow.
I know. But the basic pattern of the campaign, especially the southern campaign that I talked about, is it basically goes like this. The French approach a very strong English garrison holding, like, held up in a fortress somewhere on the Loire. The French then argue about whether or not they should attack such a strong position, and then Joan says, "Hey, God told us he was with us. We should go attack the English." Like, she says several times, "If God was not here telling me that I'm going to do this, I would be home gathering sheep, not soldiers." And Joan eventually persuades the French to attack. And then somehow they win with very few losses. Often they attack and then they start retreating. And then Joan is like, "Hello, we're attacking now."
No, but really though.
And then they win. Though. "I would be gathering sheep. Guys, I have better things to do with my time. Can we just get on with this?
Can we please just attack this fortress now? I've got some sheep to herd." So often, as they approached a fortress as well, Joan would send a letter to the commander saying, "Surrender to the King of Heaven and the noble King Charles, and go away, else great disaster will befall you."
I mean, it's nice for her to give him a heads up.
I just like that. Go away, or something real bad's gonna happen here. The most famous battle that Joan fought in was probably, well, besides raising the siege of Orléans, was the Battle of Patay. One of the few battles held in a field rather than a fortress. Yeah, so the Battle of Patay has been called the opposite of Agincourt, as it was a group of French cavalry which attacked English archers and routed them, decimating their army and capturing one of its most important commanders, John Falstaff. Oh, sorry, Fastolf. Fastolf? I can't pronounce his name.
John.
Fast laugh.
Face.
Sorry, wait.
No.
Face. John Face Lamp. I think John. I might have actually typed it wrong. I think it's Falstaff, and I've just typed it wrong in my notes. But
John. Okay, Footloose.
Losses for the Battle of Patay and the following pursuit were announced as the English having lost 2,200 troops. You want to guess how many the French lost?
4.
3.
Whoa, that was close.
That was very close.
Wow, though.
Anyway, eventually they made it to Reims. Reims welcomed them, and Charles was crowned. Charles the VII. And then another one of Joan's missions was fulfilled. She had raised the siege of Orléans. She had brought the king to the cathedral to crown him. And after this, Joan wrote even more letters. When I say wrote them, she dictated them and signed them. Joan couldn't read or write. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
In fact, all she ever wrote was her own name. We do have, by the way, Joan's signature. But it said that even when she wrote it, someone had to guide her hand to write the letters.
Interesting.
She, in these letters, encouraged the Burgundians to return to their rightful king, and they didn't listen, so she and the French continued to push them and the English out. Eventually, this led to an attack on Paris. During this fight, Joan was shot in the leg by a crossbow bolt while she was helping with some ladders. And she stayed up with the troops in the front line until someone physically carried her out. It said that Charles may not have authorized the attacks on Paris, but it was most likely just because if he did, it would look kind of like he was, and it seems like he would really be willing to sign a peace treaty, a rather losing peace treaty with the Duke of Burgundy, but people like Lahire and Joan were, like, not having any of this. So they tried to take back Paris, and they actually weren't successful. Some people have tried to make theories about why they lost. There was a lot of confusion and fighting between the commanders, and several of them have been described as undermining Joan, and that basically people trying to say it wasn't her fault, it was all those commanders again not listening and not talking to Joan.
Is that true?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't have a lot of records from this time. We have a lot of records about the Siege of Orléans. We have a lot of records about Reims and Chinon and Vaucouleurs And we have a lot of records from her trial, which I'll talk about next time. This period's pretty blurry. We have some of the letters she wrote, but not so much, like, battle records. During the next winter, there doesn't seem to be as much fighting, probably because it's winter. Right. Joan sent a lot of letters, mostly asking for all the cities and towns of France for their committed support to their king. She also wrote a letter to the English king, basically saying, hey, go home. basically saying, we're not going to come over there in England and take your land. Get out of ours.
Oh my gosh.
She also wrote a letter to the Burgundians saying that they should be loyal to the king. And she also called them, if you really want to, like, attack someone, why instead of attacking France, why don't you come with me and we can go attack the Hussites? She basically...
Who are those?
The Hussites in Bohemia were a group of heretics, which Joan was like, we could go on a crusade instead of fighting the French! The Burgundians did not take her up on it. They did not respond.
That's shocking.
But she tried.
That's shocking to me.
Yeah. I know. At some point during this winter, or before, I think before, Joan and her family were ennobled by the king, giving them official coat of arms.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah. This also exempted her family from certain taxes, which was great.
That's always good.
So Joan's coat of arms is a plain blue, azure, whatever, field with a sword pointing up in the middle and a golden crown at its point and two golden fleur-de-lis on each side. Today was all about Joan's military campaigns. Her campaigns are dotted with lots of really cool accounts that I don't really have time to go into about basically showing her virtue and a few of kind of small miracles. For instance, one story is she had a great black charger, a war horse, that was putting up a real fight and not letting her mount it. So she told the people trying to hold the horse, lead it to the cross. And they brought it across the street to a church where there was a cross. And then the horse let her get on. And she turned back to the churchmen and told them that they should lead a procession to pray for the battle and then rode off. And there's lots of little stories like that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm interested in how she falls from grace, because things seem to be going pretty well for our girl.
That is what we're going to talk about next time. Okay. So I just want to sum up right fast. So last time we talked about 17 years of Joan's life, from her being born to her coming to meet the Dauphin. This time we talked about 1 year.
Oh, good.
She met the Dauphin in early March, raised the Siege of Orléans in early May, brought Charles to Reims Cathedral in mid-July, and continued fighting till at least September when she was around Paris. So between March and September, Joan went on at least 3 campaigns and took lots of fortresses and raged a major siege and helped crown a king and all that stuff. So she was only around 18 at this point.
Heck, she's young.
I know, she was 18. Anyway, the next May, just barely a year after she lifted the Siege of Orléans, Joan's story takes a real turn. So next time we're going to talk about Joan's capture, her trial, and her death.
The whole time you've been talking, I've been thinking about what you said last time about the fact that you believe her.
Yeah.
And just this whole thing that you've gone through about everything, all the prophecies she made, the things she said, you know, God sent me to do this. Mm-hmm. And it happened, and the whole fact that it was even for the English a theological crisis, her victories, is just really fascinating to me, because I think when I've ever heard the story of Joan, it was always as just kind of this example of girl power.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of people do want to just consider Joan an early feminist, and I don't think she was one.
It's kind of reductive.
And that's, by the way, not me saying anything bad about feminists at all. It's just, she didn't spend her time saying, look how great women are. She spent her time saying, I've got a job to do and I'm going to do it.
Yeah, and just...
She didn't encourage other women to come join the army, even.
And so, to hear, because part of me always wondered, okay, how did she become a saint then? It's just, she was just cool and they made her a saint. But even the fact, you know, if you're coming at it from a standpoint, you're using the Bible to judge it, there are criteria for prophets in the Bible. I think maybe in Deuteronomy or somewhere in the Old Testament it says there are going to be people who come to you and say they're prophets. This is how you'll know they're real, and how you'll know they're from God is if what they say happens. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that she supposedly made all these prophecies, and, you know, God told me to do this, and I'm going to do it, and then it happened. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow I'm going to get hit by an arrow, and then it happens, yep. You know, move yep, before you get hit by a cannon, and then boom, there's a cannon. All of those things it's a very theological argument on her part, and even just her piety mm-hmm. and her insistence on everyone around her honoring God. It's like
you get the impression that it is definitely not about her.
Yeah. And it's interesting how much the people around her made it about her, actually. When she first got to Orléans, they tried to almost sneak her in at night, not to get her past the English, but so that they wouldn't cause a riot. When she first came to Orléans on her white horse, the people crowded around her and strained to touch her, to touch the horse, because, and it was described as if these people had a reaction as if God had descended to them, and they knew that they would be saved now that she is here. And even later, when she's during her trial, and she being brought from the place of trial to the place of execution, people were straining to touch her, basically, the way that they would, as if she was already a saint.
It's just funny, because when I hear stories like that, it makes me more inclined to believe her, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, talk about an appeal to authority.
The Lord of Heaven.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it's interesting how much she also respects the king as the chosen of God, basically.
Do you think they were friends, her and Charles? They were certainly confidants, but...
Yeah, I don't know. Joan spent probably the most time around Charles during the trip to Reims. Lahir and Dunois seemed to be her friends as well, very trusted of her. It's hard for me to say because he's her king, and it's hard to see what some of the stuff she says about him and to him, half of it might be translated as, we're friends, I trust you, but it seems much more like, well, he's the king, obviously, as God's chosen, he's a good guy. Maybe they were. They were confidants, but... It's hard for me to say whether or not they were friends. I'd like to think so, but at the same time, he is the king, and she has great respect for this. But yeah, those are my 5 pages of notes.
Yay!
On Joan of Arc's military campaigns.
So in 1 year, 18-year-old Joan of Arc crowned the king, raised the siege of Orléans, and commanded an army, and came back several times from mortal wounds. What have I done in my life in the past year?
Right? Oh, not to mention took countless fortresses and fought in the Battle of Patay.
If I'm right about what I believe your postgrad problem is, Hannah Nestor, I think this is a good segue.
Oh.
It's actually not going to be my postgrad problem this time.
Oh,
but okay. Next time it will be. I'm more prepared. I'm not prepared for that postgrad problem yet. I have.
We'll burn that.
Too much of a problem.
Yeah, it's still too much of a problem.
It'll probably segue nicely into that one too.
Oh my gosh! I'm sorry. I've just realized.
What?
The story about the bridge.
What?
They burned that bridge when they got there. Sorry, please do your postgrad problem so I can stop laughing.
Well, ironically enough, I was going to do a postgrad problem and start with a story about how I nearly set my house on fire.
Oh, good.
Please do. Did you burn that bridge when you got there?
No, but I nearly burnt my house down.
Hey, don't do that.
It's bad. It's a bad idea.
Okay.
I just want to preface by saying, I know, Russell, you said that a lot of what you call post-brad problems. I am not Angelina Jolie, and so...
I don't know anybody named Brad. False. I actually do know a couple people named Brad.
Not being Angelina Jolie, I have zero post-brad problems.
Good. That was good.
Good to hear.
Yeah, post-grad problems. You said a lot of yours are actually going to be more expat problems.
Yes.
I think I'm learning that a lot of mine are not so much post-grad problems in a unique sense as just problems that everyone deals with that show up in unique ways at different times of life.
This whole adult thing sucks.
Yeah. Adulthood, gross.
But it's not like it's not something we don't deal with in college or after we have landed in the magical realm.
I'm very curious now.
So I got really sick a lot the first of the year.
Oh no.
I was just sick all the time and having terrible migraines, and so I decided I need to take better control of my health.
Yes.
Such an adult.
I know
where this is going, and I'm preparing myself.
And so I decided to do a new diet for a month that cut out a lot of things that aren't good for you, or have the potential to not be good for you.
Cleo, diets scare me.
It's less of a diet and more just like a way to keep track of what kind of food I was eating. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't count carbs and, you know, I cut out things like added sugar and dairy and grains.
That's exactly what I would call a diet.
I was not limiting myself portion wise and counting calories and weighing myself.
I think I'd rather do the other. I would rather limit portions and not have to cut out grains. Like,
would you let this woman finish?
Okay, I'm sorry. Please tell us about your life. I'm sorry.
So, yeah, it's just been something, and I have three days left of this. And for me, it was more just another way. Again, I needed to be more mindful about what I was eating and how I was taking care of myself. Mm-hmm. Because you know, when you're in college, you have a tendency to really eat poorly.
Just eat whatever crosses your face.
Whatever is in the cafeteria, even if it's been there for a week.
Just inhale.
And so you can't do that forever and expect your body to be okay with that. So my body really just...
No one told me!
I felt like my body just had this moment where it was like, you know, you're trying to do too much and you're not taking care of yourself very well. I was just kind of screaming at me to please do something different. So I did that, and it's been an adventure, and I chose this particular plan in part because it forces me to get in the kitchen, which I like. I like to cook, and it forces me to get creative with recipes because there's so much that I haven't eaten. You know, beans.
That's good. That's awesome.
Beans and rice and pasta, which are a huge part of my diet. Especially the rice. The rice has been really hard.
Rice is hard. People are like, oh, rice is easy. You're not going to mess it up.
Rice has been hard. I'm terrible at cooking rice.
I never eat rice.
I've always cooked in a rice cooker. And so
how are you guys so bad at rice? It's not that hard.
I learned that if I have to cook rice in a pot, I cook twice as much because the bottom half of it is going to burn, but the top half is going to be good.
I have burnt rice once in my life.
Like, the last three times I have had to cook rice, I have called science and been like, science, how do you cook rice? But I don't have a rice cooker, so I just don't make rice now. Instead, I just get, like, tortilla chips and things.
Rice cookers are amazing, and everyone should have them.
No, they suck.
No,
you could just...
they are
no,
beautiful.
No, you're paying $30 for something
this
you don't
This is not
need.
A fight we're having, girls.
But the very first night, so I went for, like, a month and read everything about this plan that I could and how to make it successful and what recipes can I do, and I did a bunch of recipe planning. It forced me to be more disciplined, too, because I'm not good at planning ahead, especially when it comes to shopping, and that's been another problem with my health, is I just go to the store and buy whatever I see.
that is a problem.
I've done that before.
And
it's
so
not good.
Mainly, for me, it's been more mental benefits, but I got really into it, and the first night, I was like, I'm gonna roast a chicken.
Ooh.
So...
how'd that go? Is this when you burn your house down?
This is where I almost burned my house down, because...
Yes!
Being the adult that I am, no one ever told me that there is a limit to the time you should put parchment paper in the oven.
So
I put parchment paper on my pan, and I'm like, this is so great. First day of my diet, I am food prepping, I am doing healthy chicken things, I am so good at this, you know, put the chicken in the oven, and started roasting it and keeping an eye on it. And of course, you know, the chicken fat is popping and the paper starts getting really dark and really brown, and it's starting to make me nervous. And then I see sparks coming up from the chicken fat.
No!
So I got really, I'm like, can parchment paper burn? I don't know. When I read all this stuff online, everyone who's done this said that they cook meat with parchment paper, so that's what I'm gonna do. Even though I've never used it for anything longer than 10 minutes as cookies or something. But it's paper, and paper can burn. What if it does burn? And at this point, it's kind of late. And the rest of my family's asleep, and the last thing that I want to do is, you know, have to wake up my family and be like, guys, we have to get out. I set, you know, I'm on this new diet, and I set the house on fire.
I'm sorry. Hopefully the fire alarms would wake them up.
I mean, hopefully, yes. So I pulled out the chicken and removed this very burnt-looking parchment paper.
Oh, no.
I wrapped the chicken in tinfoil, and it cooked fine, and everyone was good, but,
Always use tinfoil.
Always use tinfoil. Moral of the story. Do not roast chickens with parchment paper.
I have a question. Am I remembering this wrong, or did you text me that day being like, can parchment paper burn?
I did, yes.
All right. I did think so.
I was like,
if you had texted me, I would have been like, sure, why not?
But I was in the middle of trying to decide if I needed to take it out or not, and so I texted my favorite scientist and was like, can this catch on fire?
Is it flammable?
And you texted me, I'm like, because it looks kind of bad, and I think I'm going to take it out. And you texted me back, and was like, yes, it can, and take it out of the oven.
It makes me think of that thing. The words not flammable written on a substance are not a challenge.
So that's when... Yeah, that's been the most dramatic, other than me whining to the two of you, but it's been good because I cut all added sugar out completely. I cut caffeine out for 2 weeks, and it's been good.
Terrible.
It was terrible at first. Like, 3 days into it, I had the world's worst combined caffeine-sugar withdrawal. But, I don't know. I've been trying not to be obnoxious about it. I've probably been more obnoxious because I keep texting you guys every other day and being like, I want pasta.
No, I'm glad that you're enjoying the cooking aspect, though.
Yeah, like, way to choose a plan that plays to your strengths, like, involving the research and the cooking and the creativity. Like, this is killer.
I would not have been able to do it otherwise, but, yeah, so I don't know if you guys have any comments or thoughts on being healthier and eating different foods. I know I sent you guys a picture one time. I made this beanless, cornless, dairy-free chicken chili, which was basically like a soup.
It's not chili.
Yeah, and we said something
we had this
like
discussion.
I was like, okay, fine, I'll turn it into chili. I'll just add beans. And you were arguing about whether or not you could actually put chicken in chili, which apparently is something people don't do in your part of the country.
Yeah, no, in the West we have real meat.
That's you can make that with chicken. It's just not chili anymore.
It's good soup.
I cannot comment on being healthy. I have been trying to cut down the amount of sugar I eat, but when you say like healthy food, I have eaten a honestly shocking amount of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in the last 3 days. And I have a burn on my arm from this last time I was cooking bacon and sausage, because a significant amount of my meals come in the form of potatoes and bacon these days.
I have a question.
Yes.
It's very good.
What is a shocking number of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches?
How many do you think you can make out of a loaf of bread?
Oh my gosh, you've eaten that in the last 3 days?
You've eaten a whole loaf of
bread? I mean, maybe more than three, but I've eaten a lot of peanut butter. Basically, okay, so do you guys do this, aside from your special diet stuff, I go through phases where I eat a lot of one food, and then I stop eating it and pick up another one?
Yep.
So, like, I'll go through a phase where I make...
I go through sweet potato phases.
Yeah. So, like, I went through a phase where I made a lot of my own pizzas. And then I still have, like, a couple of pizza-making things. But then I started making a lot of mashed potatoes and sausage. And then I started making a lot of this or that or the other thing. I kind of go through these phases where you kind of, you now know what it takes. Like, there was this one time I made the same taquito recipe 3 times in a row. I made it, I ate all of it, and then I just made more. Well, right now, I am on peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah, no, I can't do that, because if I do, okay, so I'll make something that I can eat every day of the week. Like, I'll make a big old pot of chili. That's a great idea. Bring chili to lunch all week. Okay, by about day 3, I'm bored with chili. And by day 4, I'm eating out rather than eating chili again.
I do that.
That happens to me on occasion, but then other things happen. A lot of my meals will only cook for 3 meals, and then what'll happen is, or actually no, a lot of them will do things like this. Like, I have this one pasta dish that involves mushrooms, but you can't buy the amount of mushrooms I need for it. You can only buy, like, 3 times that amount of mushrooms. So I just plan to make it 3 times in a row before the mushrooms go bad.
Which makes sense, and I do that sometimes, but I'll make a bunch and I'll freeze it for later so that, like, in a week or two, I'm like, you know, it sounds really good.
I don't have super great access to a freezer at the moment.
Yeah, no, that's understandable. I have my own fridge and stuff, but...
Yeah. I made the mistake last week. When I first started this, I went and hit the meat sale, so I got this really, like, 4-pound roast.
Nice.
And it was good. The only problem was I forgot. I always forget when I'm just cooking for myself. And so
I never just cook for me. I mean, I do. I always cook for me. I just cook as if I'm cooking for 7 people.
Yeah, exactly. So I put the roast in the crock pot Wednesday night and woke up Thursday. And, well, no, it was overnight? Tuesday.
Yeah. I've never left something in overnight.
And it was Tuesday. And by like, Friday night, I was so sick of roast because I kept trying to tell my family, would you please eat roast? And they're like, oh, no, we're good. We have other stuff. I'm like, no, you don't understand.
No.
I need you to eat the roast.
Get away from me.
This is the 5th meal that I have had roast in some form. I have done that
exact thing with pork roast before. So I do understand this.
But yeah, this whole thing for me has just been less about, because like I said, I don't want to be that obnoxious person who turns every conversation into, I don't eat bread.
I'm but not gonna lie to you, there was a week when I was very scared you were gonna be that person.
I was too, but that was it the first week? Because I was just whining at that point.
I mean, I would have been.
But,
if I ever go on a diet, you two will know.
I mean, you text us pretty much every thought anyway, so.
It's true.
But for me, it was more just proving to myself that I had the ability to say no to certain things.
That's so good. Yeah, I do not. I'm not sure I do have that ability.
It was more of a mental than a physical exercise, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a physical exercise like at all. It's a diet.
No, it was not a physical exercise. It was a physical exercise involved.
In any case.
So, let's talk about what we're into briefly. Can I tell you guys what I'm into this week?
Please do.
Yes, please.
Okay, so I just bought a ticket to PodCon. I've already texted you guys about this, but PodCon is very exciting. It's being organized by the guys who run Nightvale Present, Hank Green of the Vlog Brothers, and Travis McElroy of the McElroy Brothers.
Oh my gosh.
Yay.
Yeah, exactly.
All of those people are amazing.
And they're all doing live shows. They're doing a live show of Alice Isn't Dead, they're doing a live show of Verbindum. They're doing a live show of Dear Hank and John, which is the Vlog Brothers
podcast. These are all my favorite things.
I know. I'm freaking out about it. I bought a ticket. Okay, so I kind of bought it because, like, okay, first of all, it's in Seattle, which
I'm
is
so jealous.
One of 4 cities I can go to from the Missoula airport.
Wait, what are the other 3?
It's like Portland, Denver, and somewhere in Canada. I don't know. but yeah, no, it's in Seattle, which means I only have to take 1 flight. Nice. It's in December, which means I have plenty of time to save up for, like, hotels and food and that kind of thing. And it was relatively inexpensive, so...
If I was anywhere near Seattle, I'd go.
I know. Awesome. Like, I'd pay $90 just to see these live shows, but to go to a con, too. They're gonna have workshops, they're gonna have panels. It's for people who both are fans of and, make podcasts, so it's probably a good networking opportunity for us.
Yeah.
Like... I'm insanely excited about it. Y'all should maybe go consider supporting it. Actually, there is a remote admission kind of thing.
Yeah, I will definitely be doing that one.
Yeah, so I think that that one's $25, which
yeah,
is...
Yeah, I think that one's... They don't live stream it. They record all of it, collate it, and then send it to you.
Yes, that is correct. And they put it all on... It's like a secret RSS stream or something like that.
Right.
But, like, you should definitely do that. And if any of our listeners are going to be in Seattle in December 9th and 10th, or at PodCon specifically, then... You guys should send us an email and, like, we'll meet up and say, hey, it would be nice to meet people who listen to this podcast who aren't our friends and family.
Hey, while we're on podcast, I was just going to say, I don't know where you're listening to this podcast, if it's on iTunes, if it's on our blog, if it's, I don't know where else this goes up. But it would be really great if some people who are listening would just drop us a comment on iTunes or something like that. I don't think we have any reviews at the moment.
Give us a rate and review.
Yeah, that would be really great.
It helps other people find the podcast,
share this
which
show,
would be nice.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. We haven't been able to do a ton about getting this podcast out yet. We're still on a bit of a crazy publication schedule, mostly because I live in...
another
6 hours away across an ocean, but yeah, we're really hoping to continue this. We really like doing this, and it would be great to hear from some people, but especially those iTunes reviews. Those can be really important.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Thank you.
And thanks for listening.
For sure. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us at theliberalarnts@gmail.com. We're on Facebook at The Liberal Arnts, and then of course there's our website, theliberalarnts.com. We'd love to hear from you. I think we have one piece of listener mail, is that right?
Yes, we do.
It's from my sister, if I'm not mistaken.
She says, and I quote, "Hey science, you're a nerd. Booyah."
You've got to get the inflection right. It's like, "Hey science, you're a nerd. Booyah." That's how you do that.
I feel like your family has its own inflection rules that are outside the bounds of all others.
And to my sister, I reply, well, if you're listening to this podcast, you're learning all sorts of interesting things about history and science and culture, and therefore, you're the nerd, booyah!
Your face.
Anyway, so thank you for listening at this time. Yeah.
And thank you, science's sister.
Yes.
Thank you,
Ella. For being a nerd.
A booyah. Oh, we should thank Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our theme music and outro, and also Caitlin Thompson for designing our logo. They're great.
And all of the different versions I keep asking her to make, the different sizes that the stupid website needs.
Yeah, actually,
thank you very much, Caitlin.
We're going to ask her to make another one so I can pass out some little cards at PodCon. So thanks, Caitlin.
Thank you.
We love you.
We do. Thanks for listening to The Liberal Arnts. We'll be back in a couple weeks to talk about... What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah.
What are we talking about?
We're going to talk about turkey.
More about turkey. The country, not the bird. Until then, learn something worth knowing. Yeah.